Accession number 9282, Reel 1.
Lady Corbett, Reel 1. Could you tell me a little about your family background, please?
Yes, certainly. I am a third generation New Zealander. My mother's parents emigrated in a sailing ship from Greenock in Scotland in 1875, and they went to Dunedin, New Zealand, which is a very Scottish town, and they took five children with them, and my mother was the first one that was born in New Zealand. And Jean Begg, of YWCA fame, was my mother's youngest sister, so she too was born in New Zealand. My father was born in Arbroath in Scotland, and he was taken aged 8 with, I think, about 10 other children to Sydney in Australia, where he lived until he went to New Zealand and married my mother. So that's how I came to be born of Scottish parents. I was born in Dunedin and I was raised in Christchurch. My father was a tradesman who used to put slates on roofs. He was a slater. And during the Depression times, which of course was when I was a teenager, my parents were good enough in the Scottish tradition to send me to the university when things were financially quite difficult. But they were very good indeed about sending me off to the university. And I graduated with a Master of Science in First Class Honours in Chemistry. And I became an analytical chemist. And I was working as an analytical chemist in Wellington and in Auckland, back in Wellington, when the war was coming along. And at that moment, Mrs. Churchill, she was Mrs. Churchill then, Mrs. Churchill was the chairman of the overseas branch of the YWCA of Great Britain. And they were thinking what they could do to help women in uniform. And they thought it would be a very good idea if they started some clubs in the Middle East. And so they looked around and said, who do you think we could get to do this job, because it's not easy? And Jean Begg, who was then retiring from being the General Secretary of the YWCA of India, Burma and Ceylon, they sent her a cable, would she undertake this work? And she cabled back and said, yes, when do I start? They said, as soon as you can get to Cairo. So she flew, for the first time in her life, from Calcutta to Cairo and got in touch with the YWCA there and started this magnificent work that went on from middle 1940 to the end of 1947. And here was I, an analytical chemist in New Zealand, and so I thought, well, I'll write to her and say, if she wants any staff, I think I could get leave and come. So at that moment, I was the analytical chemist for the Wellington City Council, doing water supplies and all sorts of things, concrete and all sorts of things. And she cabled back and said, yes, please send two staff. She sent to the Defence Department of New Zealand, please send me, Betty Lorimer, and another staff to me to Cairo. And so we got on a troop ship and went.
Could we just go back briefly to the declaration of war? How did you feel when you realised that war was inevitable?
Well, it didn't make any difference to us in New Zealand. I had had two uncles. My mother's two brothers had gone to the First World War, and they had both come back. And there were a lot of people died as a result of the First World War. But in our immediate family and amongst our immediate friends, there were nobody had died. They had all come back, including my two uncles. So that the outbreak of war didn't really mean much to us in New Zealand, and it didn't mean much to me, except that here was a chance of getting overseas, which every New Zealander is dying to do. Every New Zealander wants to go on a trip to the homeland, to England. And of course, I was dying to go and didn't have the financial resources to bring myself to England. And so here was a chance, perhaps, I could go. So
what did your parents feel about that?
Oh, they were quite happy. And they knew I was going to Jean. I was going to Jean Beg, so they knew I would be all right if I was with her. That was perfectly all right. And I was, by way of being a very independent young lady, mad keen on mountaineering. You know, first up a mountain here and the first up a mountain, you know, with a party and that sort of thing. So I was physically extremely fit and well able to go. And so we got on a troop ship and went. And we zigzagged across the Pacific Ocean for 6 weeks. I've never been so bored in my life. I had to play bridge. It was terrible because I had nothing to do. And I learned to play bridge for 6 weeks. And we landed in Suez.
Could you tell me a little more about the journey? Who were you travelling with?
Oh, well, New Zealand troops. It was a New Zealand troop ship. And it was...
Were there many other women aboard?
Yes, there were nurses. There were no ATS in those days, or Wrens or anybody. There was only the New Zealand nurses. And the matron who was travelling with them, we two YWCA staff were sort of, you know, with the other women. There must have been, I suppose, about 20 or 30 women. And there would be at least 500 to 1,000 troops. And we went across, we sailed from Auckland, and we went across to Sydney, and we joined up with a convoy that then proceeded to go off to Suez.
But how did you feel as a woman having to travel with all those thousands of
men? Oh, that's all right. Oh, for we New Zealanders are like that. You know, you put up with these things. And
excuse me, just...
It so happened that the night we got into Suez, the ITIs bombed the Suez Canal. And it was the only time in the entire war period that I ever heard a bomb. And it was quite a long way from us because we were out in Suez Bay and the ITIs were bombing the actual canal. And it was after the ITIs bombing the Suez Canal that all the convoys had to go around the Cape. But our ship even was deflected. But we disembarked.
But how did you feel about this bomb?
Oh, all right. No problem to us.
You weren't frightened?
Oh, no. Nothing to be frightened of. It was a noise that was away. And that was the only bombs I ever heard because I was away in Middle East and Far East through the entire war. And I'd never been in England in my life. And I was always dying to get there, so I did in the end. But it took quite a long time. But that was perfectly all right. We disembarked. And I think... Yes. Jean Beg, at that time, she had come to Ismailia, which is on Lake Timsa, which is in the middle of the Suez Canal. There's some lovely great big lakes there. And she was in Lake Timsa. She was in Ismailia on Lake Timsa, and she met us off the troop train. My friend Meg Saunders and I, we disembarked in Ismailia, and there was Jean Beg. And she was a very wonderful woman, great action woman. She had acquired a very nice building. It must have been a series of flats together. And she had managed to furnish it. And already she had Australian nurses in from the desert outside Ismailia in the house, which was pretty marvellous. And this was my first introduction to living in the East. And the thing that I remember mostly was my shock at eating the main meal of the day at 8 o'clock at night. That to a New Zealander was a terrible surprise because we New Zealanders, you know, we eat, you know, ordinary hours, like you have your lunch at 12, you have your evening meal at 6, and you have supper, which is just a simple cup of tea and a sandwich or something about 10 o'clock at night. And I didn't know what you did. What do you do between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock if you haven't eaten a meal? And we had to, we got used to it. And my first introduction to the bugs of the East was we had hospital beds which have got those iron tube tops and bottoms. And Jean said, look, we've got to clean these beds. And I said, why? She said, well, come up, bring them up on the roof and I'll show you. Because she had lived in India, Burma and Ceylon, and she understood these things. And lo and behold, we turned these tubes, which were the bed ends, upside down, and out fell a forest of bedbugs. Well, and in those days, there was no treatment for them except paraffin. So we had paraffin and we poured it into these tubes and we stood on or burnt off these bugs. The roof, of course, was hot because it was the hot weather. And this stone roof was very hot, so these bugs just fell onto the roof and we disposed of them and put the beds together and went on again. But from then onwards, your life was a complete fighting against the bugs. We had mosquitoes, we had cockroaches, we had bed bugs. Bed bugs were the worst. We'd always fighting them. And, you know, this is when, because immediately we were setting up clubs for service women. And in the end, we finished up by having a series of clubs from Tripoli to Tokyo. Some of the staff, I didn't go off to Tripoli or Italy. I went the other way. But my, and Jean Biggs, I suppose we were in Ismailia with her for a little while, and she said, now we'll go up to Cairo. I've got to find a building in Cairo that we can have as a residential club.
Could you tell me a little more about Ismailia before we move on to Cairo? What were your actual duties there?
Oh, well, it was always my job with several other members of staff, if we had any, to find a building. In Ismailia, Jean Beck had found this building. And then she found, or she persuaded the Suez Canal Company to give her the headquarters of the Suez Canal Company, the manager of the Suez Canal Company's beautiful house in Ismailia, which was on the shores of Lake Timsa. And Jean Beck always specialised in getting the best building. For instance, she got Raffles Hotel in Singapore and so on. And so I didn't have anything to do with the movement from the first building we had and moving into the Suez Canal Company building. Another New Zealander did that, Muriel Wilson did that. But Jean Beg, she took me up to Cairo and said we must find a place in Cairo. We hadn't found it at that moment. But she took me out into the desert, outside Ismailia, and this was the most extraordinary sight. It was just a bare desert. But there were little square boxes over this desert for miles. And these boxes were laid out in places, you know, in squares, and there was a sort of a track in between these boxes. And I said to her, now, what on earth's that? And she said, oh, those are the latrines for the troops who are coming in here very shortly. And then she drove me or took me to a spot in the desert where there was a very small pile of bricks, nothing else. It was just these rows of latrines spreading in all directions, and there was a pile of bricks there, quite a small pile, this high. And she said, now Canal North headquarters are going to be there, and the troops are all coming into these camps that are all around here, and over there there's going to be two Australian hospitals, and down there there's going to be two South African hospitals, and back over here there's going to be an ordnance depot plus some British hospitals in Tel El Kebir, a few miles away, and that's where Vera Harley was. And did she tell you about Tel El Kebir? Yes, well, I was a few miles away with a bare bit of desert, with nothing. And she said, you better build it. You better design it and build it. So we set to work and designed and built it. We got great cooperation from the Royal Engineers.
How did you do? I mean, what was your first move?
Oh, I've forgotten. I did it so often. You know, the first thing you ever did was to go to the Royal Engineers. Yes. That's how I met my husband. Oh, he was a Royal Engineer in Calcutta. And you went to the Royal Engineers and you said, you know, we really want the plan and we think we'd like to have it this big and this and that. And then you got somebody to build it. And then you set to work to furnish it. And furnishings are always difficult. Because
how long did it actually take to build?
Oh, not very long. A few weeks.
So what did you do in the meantime?
Oh, I was keeping my eye on it, running to and from Ismailia, running to and from... in the meantime, we had bought a Model T Ford, and I could drive, and I was... This was the only car we had, was this Model T Ford, and it used to get stuck in the sand, and there were always loads of Egyptian workmen round, and you sort of said, you know, come on over, and we got lifted out and went on. Always getting stuck in the sand because that's what the desert was. There were no roads or anything. And then...
But this had been the first time you'd left home.
Yes.
Presumably. How were you coping in a foreign country? And
oh, perfectly all right. No problem at all. Because, you see, Jean Begg was there with this terrific personality of hers and her terrifically quick brain. And if there was going to be any trouble, she would anticipate it. So there was no trouble. You just got on with the job. And we got to know the New Zealand soldiers who were in Ismailia. There was a big New Zealand rest camp there. And the head of the rest camp, a man called Clive Cameron, Major Clive Cameron, was a great help because he knew how to contact the ordnance depots and he knew how to do this. And after the foundations were in and the building was going up, we said, well, we'll have to do something about having some trees or something around here. And so, you know, in the hot weather, the temperature's about 100. And you had these sand devils coming on you, great sand devils, were great whirls of sand that moved across the desert. And you hope they didn't come through your house, but if they did, it was a bit of a nuisance. And but we decided we better have something round the house. And so Major Cameron was able to take us to a place where they grew trees in kerosene tins. And we got these out to Tahag. This camp was called Tahag Camp, Tahag Kassasin. And we were in Tahag Camp. And we somehow or other the engineers put the water supply on. We had a good water supply. Engineers are good about water supplies. And the thing we needed in order to grow these trees was some Nile mud from the Sweetwater Canal, which was just a few miles from us. The Sweetwater Canal ran, I mean, it wasn't salt water, it was fresh water. It ran from Cairo to Ismailia, and the Sweetwater Canal was only just a little way away. So I spoke to... In the meantime, the camp had filled up, of course. And all these rows of latrines were used by this regiment and that regiment and this regiment and that regiment.
Which particular regiments were there?
Oh, I've forgotten. English ones they were. The New Zealanders were in Ismailia, and there was an Australian group in the Ordnance Depot where Vera Harley was at Tel El Kebir, but these were all English regiments. And this was the time they were coming back from the Western Desert. Do you remember they retreated out of the Western Desert and then they went back again? Well, this was in the retreat of the Western Desert. And the nurses had arrived. The hospitals, the two British General Hospitals had arrived. And we were establishing ourselves quite well. But let me finish the story about the planting of the trees. Here we had trees in kerosene tins, and we had water to water them with. And we had Italian prisoners of war who came to look after the garden and to lay it out and dig holes. So all we needed was some Nile mud to put in the holes. So we got a South African unit to go down to the Sweetwater Canal and bring back. And I only wanted a truck full of mud, but I looked out one morning and here were 12 vehicles full of Nile mud. So we had plenty of Nile mud, and we were able to establish a very good garden because, one, there was plenty of room for it because it was the whole of the desert. Two, we had plenty of Nile mud. And three, we had the Italian prisoners of war to dig the holes where we wanted them. And four, we had the trees that had come from the New Zealand depot in Ismailia. And so this was rather fun. And then we started, of course, we were able to... this was not a residential club. This was a club that had a big veranda around it. And the nurses used to come over from the hospital, which was just across the road, and they used to bring their boyfriends, and the surgeons from over there used to come over and have a meal, you know, afternoon tea or morning tea or have lunch or dinner, and we were able to lay all that on.
What were you providing? Food and meals. Recreational facilities?
It was mostly just food. And then we used to run dances. And they came from everywhere to our... The men came from everywhere to our dances. And... the women nurses came over from the hospitals, and then when the South African hospitals turned up, there were even more women. So this was a great day, and we the YWCA didn't serve any alcoholic beverages, so we just had soft things. And I think the men used to have something in their cars outside, but never inside. And this was very good because it really worked very well. One of the things we really wanted to have, you see, the nurses were living in tents and the walls were flapping. And in Egypt, it can be very windy. And here they were living in these wretched tents and the walls flapping. And here they could come over to us where we had solid brick walls. And they sat down at a table and they had given a very nice meal or cup of tea with nicely home-cooked food. And it was just so different. But the one thing they really wanted to have, they really missed, was a loo, a pull-chain loo. So we decided that we'd better have a pull-chain loo. And this is a really funny story, this one. In order to have a waterborne sewage in the desert, what you had to do in order to dispose of the surplus water, you had to dig a great big trench and you had to fill it up with big stones, and then you had to cover it up with sand, and then you pulled the chain and off it went down into this big hole. So the engineers were cooperative as always, and but the trouble was the stone didn't come. And here were we, I think the engineers by this time had installed the actual loos, and the water supply was laid on, but you couldn't get rid of the... You couldn't get rid of what you wanted to. And I got to know the name, the felucca. Felucca was a boat, an Egyptian boat sailing on the canals. And the felucca that was collecting this stone from somewhere, it was up near Cairo, it had to come down the canals to come down to us. He passed his village that he lived in. So he stayed there for a couple of weeks before he came on with the stone. And I used to get into my car. By this time I had a station wagon instead of the Model T Ford, and go and look for this wretched felucca. And I found it several, you know, villages up the Sweetwater Canal. And finally we managed to get it. And finally we got the stone filled into the trench. And finally you could pull the chain, and they loved it because the women used to, you know, it was we planted these loos in between our club and the hospitals. and there was a constant stream walking across the canal in order to have the pleasure of sitting on a, on a waterborne loo. And really, that was really quite something, because the women, they really appreciated the solid walls. They really appreciated that they could bring their boyfriends and men friends. And, of course, we were all... rank was nothing to us, male or female. The matron-in-chief could bring her B.O.R. nephew into our club, particularly in Cairo, because that was where the ranks could meet. And but we started... The first job I did was in Tahag. And then I...
Well, could you tell me, after the building was complete, how did you set about getting furnishing and staff?
Oh, well, Jean Begg found a dear little old woman called Tristy, Miss Tristram. Miss Tristram had been a missionary in the Sudan for 40 years, and she loved sandstorms. And she sent Tristy down to me at Tahag, and Tristy, having been in the Sudan, understood about Egyptian staff. So she recruited the staff. I think we took her into Ismailia, and somehow or other Tristy got the staff. She got a cook and a cleaners and a this and all the ones we needed, probably about half a dozen. And
where did these people live?
I was just wondering where we accommodated them, because we were away from the Sweetwater Canal. I think we must have built some staff quarters somewhere. The Egyptians. They would be separate. They, in the East, the staff quarters are always separate from the main building. But you've got to have them. And I think we must have had a place for them. And we probably put them behind some of these trees, which were now growing quite nicely. And I went back to Tahag. I'd been away somewhere, I think in Iraq or somewhere. And I came back to Egypt, probably to get supplies for Iraq. And I went down to Tahag and I sat in this nice club we had, and I was drinking a cup of tea or eating something or other, and I said, "What's that?" There was some noise. And do you know what it was? It was the wind in the trees. They'd grown so quickly with all this Nile mud, that, and they were mostly Australian eucalypts, which grow very easily and quickly in the desert. And after 2 or 3 years, it must have been only 2 years, I think, you could hear the wind in the trees from these little kerosene tins that we'd planted here and there. And it turned out to be quite a success. So but that was Tahag. Would you like to ask me anything else about that?
Yes, please. What about actually furnishing the camp?
Well, it was always...